Hello, is this thing on? But we're gonna give it a go. Hi, I'm Olivia, and Jay's not here. And this is Highbrow Theater, a podcast where we talk about plays usually, but today, it's just me. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do this episode on. I knew I was gonna be by myself. I kept asking people if they wanted to be on it, and they kept saying no because it was last minute. I had the brilliant idea of looking through my old school papers and seeing if I'd ever written anything worth sharing. So it turns out, I think my sophomore year of college, I wrote this paper on theories about alternative authorship of William Shakespeare. So basically the deal is, and I'm sure you've heard this, even if you're not really a theater person, that people think that Shakespeare didn't write his plays. And there's sort of a... There's an amount of evidence that maybe someone else couldn't have written them. And there are a couple popular theories of people who might have written Shakespeare's plays. So basically the reason that we think Shakespeare didn't write his plays is because we don't know much about him. We know, you know, he grew up poor in Stratford-upon-Avon. I shouldn't clap. He grew up poor in Stratford-upon-Avon, which was not a big city. And people fixate a lot on what are called the lost years. So Shakespeare's born in 1564 in Stratford-upon-Avon. We have a record of his baptism. He pops up in like a couple other documents in Stratford-upon-Avon over the next like 23 years. And then from 1585 to 1592, we don't hear anything from him. So this is basically his 20s, early 30s. We don't know what the hell he's up to. He doesn't pop up anywhere. We don't know where he lives. We don't know if he left England. We don't know what he's doing. You know, we fathered a couple children. We have their birth certificates or whatever, their baptism certificate. I don't fucking know. But he disappears for these 8 years, okay? That's important. In 1593, approximately, the late 1500s, we start hearing about Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is a playwright at the Globe Theater. And he's kind of famous. And he's had these plays put on. So basically, people are like, how did this hick disappear for 8 years and then become a successful playwright? Because it's impossible to imagine that someone could do that, I guess. I don't know. So let's get into some of the theories of alternative authorship. Number one is Sir Francis Bacon. This is probably the most popular, I should have saved it for last, but I'm not, I already started. This is the most popular theory for the alternate Shakespeare, essentially. People think that Sir Francis Bacon wrote them, and you'll hear people say that. A lot of people will be like, oh, he didn't even write them. Sir Francis Bacon did, whatever. I mean, those are people that I hang out with. Obviously, you don't hang out with those people. This is a really popular theory, and Sir Francis Bacon, let's hear a little bit about him. So, Sir Francis Bacon, he's born in London, so that's a thing that people pay attention to because, like, Shakespeare wasn't born in London, but then he has a career in London. How does that happen? Do people move? Impossible. So, Sir Francis Bacon, born in London, 1561, older than Shakespeare by 3 years. For our year nerds, he was born to Lord Nicholas Bacon, who was an advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, and Anne Bacon, a well-educated daughter of humanist Sir Anthony Cook. So, basically, this guy gets a totally different birthright to Shakespeare, right? Shakespeare's born poor, Stratford-upon-Avon. His dad is, like, a lawyer who's been disgraced. And, you know, he grows up, you know, being a hillbilly and going to the Avon and getting a bucket of water and carrying it home. And Sir Francis Bacon is, like, a courtesan. He's born into, you know, these well-educated, well-connected people. So there's infraction one, William Shakespeare, why weren't you born rich? So Bacon, it's so funny that I have to call him that, but that's his name. Bacon, unlike Shakespeare, got this prestigious education immediately, right? So he had a private tutor at home when he was a kid, and then he went to Trinity College, he went to Cambridge. He had a tutor that was like, oh, he studied all these classical works. He studied Cicero. He studied Demosthenes. Is that right? I don't know how I'm saying that right. He studied Aristotle's Rhetoric. He studied all this stuff that, like, would in theory give him a great basis to write a play. Like, if you read, you know, Aristotle's Rhetoric, or I'm thinking of Poetics, but, like, Like, Aristotle's Poetics literally teaches you how to write a play. It's like, here's how to write a play. So this guy had that education, right? Then later in his life, Bacon goes to Paris, and then he returns to London and studies law and gets involved in Elizabethan politics. So he has this understanding of politics, and so many of Shakespeare's plays are political, right? So he's this jack of all trades. He's got it all. He's got the worldliness, he's got the education, he's got the looks, he's got the butt, he's got it all. By the time Bacon is 30, he gets elected to Parliament. House of Commons. Shout out to the House of Commons! Okay, so by the age of 30, he gets elected to Parliament. And he starts publishing written works. So at its most basic level, the theory for Bacon's authorship lies in a extremely elitist view of literature, obviously. So the people who believe in Bacon's authorship, we'll call them the Baconians. We'll call them the Baconheads. According to Baconheads, Bacon, you know, he's wealthy, he has a well-connected family, he has privilege, he has education, and that must have been what rendered him more capable of producing the greatest literature of all time than, you know, poor Hick Willie. First glance, he's like a perfect candidate. But then the Baconheads go ahead, they start finding other things, right? Once they've established that Sir Francis Bacon is a really good candidate to be the author. So a Baconian theorist named Ignatius Donnelly, that racist? You can't be racist to Irish people. Ignatius Donnelly, borderline Scottish. He proposed the first Baconhead theory in the mid 19th century. He says that Bacon left clues about his authorship in the First Folio. The First Folio is the collected publishing. Jesus. A couple of Shakespeare's friends, after Shakespeare died, collected the First Folio. It was a couple of his plays, preserved as well as they possibly could have been, and they were published. And that's like what we go on, is like the original version of these texts. Later, different versions are found. Those become the second and third folio. I think, is there a fourth? I don't know. Anyway, that's the First Folio. And the First Folio, it's important that it's that one because every version is a little bit different. Because, like, I mean, it's not that unusual. Like, there's going to be, when someone's writing and performing a play, like, there's going to be drafts. And then, you know, as the production goes on, they're going to change some words, some lines here and there. And that's the differences between the folios. The First Folio is the one that Ignatius Donnelly thinks Bacon left clues in. Bacon apparently wrote in like a journal or like some academic, a boring paper, that he was interested in using word ciphers. So like a word puzzle. You know what a cipher is? I'm like babying you. Why am I breathing so hard? It's because I'm talking so fast. Donnelly, Donkey! Donnelly's logic is that he observed every time there appeared to be a mistake in the First Folio's printing, which was apparently like really unusually error-filled. Like, there are so many errors. Like, there's irregular page numbering, there's quote meaningless bracketing, and quote senseless hyphenation. That's such a funny, like, oh, these hyphens are senseless. But he reads through and he sees all these mistakes and he interprets each mistake as a signal. So Donald, this is bonkers shit. So Donnelly says, by multiplying the number of the pages into the number of italicized words on the first few pages of Henry IV, second part, I got this significant result. Quote, Francis Bacon, St. Albans, volume, plays found. So basically, this guy was like, I'm gonna pick one letter out of every word that interests me, and that must have been a signal. Like, it's the dumbest, evidence. Like, it's a word cipher that doesn't make any sense. How would you even think to do, like, it also, like, the issue was that, like, Shakespeare wasn't around for the First Folio. I guess maybe that's the thing, because Sir Francis Bacon actually outlived Shakespeare by a few years. But I don't get it. It's not good evidence. And basically, scholars have dismissed Donnelly at having been full of shit. Basically, they were like, that's not real evidence. So a criticism of Baconian theory is that why would you write some of the best plays ever and not take credit for them? Especially since Bacon outlives Shakespeare by a few years. So it could have been like Shakespeare died and Bacon could have been like, actually, it was me the whole time. He would have taken off a Shakespeare latex mask, and underneath it was Sir Francis Bacon. Like, it's me! So So the reason people give for why Sir Francis Bacon might not want to take credit for writing, these literally beautiful plays is because Bacon's career in politics might have been tarnished if it had become public knowledge that he was writing plays for the public theater. Because at this point, the public theater is still considered by the noble classes like vulgar. Like a little bit later, when they finally let women start being actors, there's a lot of pervasive, like, oh, if a woman is an actress, she's a whore logic. So the other thing with this is that there's this guy, Alfred L. Wallace, who criticizes the bacon heads all the time. He's like, fuck these bacon heads. So eventually, there's actually an academic debate. I don't know where. Can I look this up? Actually, I'm gonna look it up real quick. Okay, I can't find it. But anyway, there's apparently an academic debate. I probably just found this on like some fucking, I found it on like Google Scholar. So who knows what these sources are. But apparently, there was an actual academic debate about this done by some really boring people. One of them was Alfred L. Wallace. He might not be boring. I should be nice. But he proceeded over this debate, and it was called Bacon v. Shakespeare. And he was anti-Baconian, and he said that Shakespeare didn't need the education that Sir Francis Bacon had because he had what he calls, quote, transcendent genius, which is meanings that he's so brilliant. He's such a great artist that he's able to bridge the gap between opportunity and artistry. He's able to bridge the gap between privilege. And like, if you think about some artists that are really famous and really influential, like this does happen. Like there are people who, maybe grow up poor, don't grow up with the opportunity to go to like poetry school, but maybe they like submit a poem to a magazine and everyone's like, oh shit, like you're Ted Hughes. Like I don't know the story of Ted. I actually think Ted Hughes. I don't know anything about Ted Hughes. Like it does happen that people are just really fucking good at what they do, and they didn't need to be smart. Maybe they read a lot of books. Maybe they, learn, they know about people. Like, it's not impossible. Yeah, I guess I'm done with that one. Well, let's zoom right into number two, and this is Edward de Vere. Like DeVille, but it's de Vere, so it's not really like DeVille. So, we have our second group of theorists. They are called Oxfordiists. Oxfordian? Oxfordians? Oxfordians. I don't know how to fucking say it. But they're called that because they believe that this guy, Edward de Vere, who is the Earl of Oxford, they think that he is the true author of Shakespeare's work. Like Sir Francis Bacon, who we just talked about, de Vere was also born into nobility and he was rich. And after his father died when he was a child, he became a ward of William Cecil, who is Queen Elizabeth's secretary. So he also, well connected with nobility, rich, knows people, can basically have access to whatever he wants, right? He's also the nephew of this guy, Arthur Golding, who translated Ovid's Metamorphosis, which is an epic poem. And people think that this epic poem, this translation in particular, had an influence on Shakespeare's narrative style. So he's enough. So people think that, yeah, basically they're like, oh, this guy's uncle wrote this thing. So maybe this guy's uncle wrote this really influential thing, so maybe he was most affected by it. It doesn't really make sense because Shakespeare also could have read Metamorphoses. The evidence for de Vere is this. He was a creative of the Renaissance, and he was associated with and received dedications from many Elizabethan writers. Dedications are something that they would do, I think, at the beginning of like their poetry things. They would be like, oh, most honorable you, what a great poet you are. Like, it's just like writers jacking each other off, basically, which is just what like Facebook groups do now. So basically, De Vere grows up rich, he grows up a creative, but then De Vere kills someone. So this one is so funny. So this guy is like rich and has all these connections, and then he kills someone. So this guy, William Cecil, he becomes De Vere's ward. And while he's his ward, De Vere kills one of Cecil's servants. So basically, everyone's like, whoa, this guy's fucked up. Because he commits a murder. Like, he's a prominent man in society, and he's gossiped about. And people think that because De Vere could not, if he wanted to be a playwright for some reason, he couldn't write under his own name because everyone was gossiping about him, he might take on the name William Shakespeare. And the theory is that, like, William Shakespeare is a real guy in this scenario, obviously. We know that he lived and died. But William Shakespeare comes from Stratford and he's a businessman. Like, he's a producer. So William Shakespeare comes in and he's gonna hustle everybody. De Vere, rich boy, comes in and says, hey, William Shakespeare, I really want to write plays, but no one will listen to me because I killed a guy. And William Shakespeare's like, don't worry, baby, you pay me and you can use my name. So that's the whole theory, is that he's pretending to be this theater businessman from Stratford-upon-Avon because he can't go by his true identity because no one would like his plays because he killed someone. And the evidence for this is basically, again, De Vere was rich, he was well-educated, he had the connection with the Metamorphosis guy. He traveled in places like France and Italy, such as like some of the cities that Shakespeare used as settings in his plays. You know, Verone. Ah. Tony, you want some cold pasta? And in 1584, which as we know is the beginning of the lost years, right? Yes, yeah, the beginning of the lost years. Queen Elizabeth I starts paying De Vere a yearly salary of £1,000, which is a lot of money. And we don't know why she starts giving him money. So people think, because she was a lover of the arts, that maybe she was paying him to write these plays that would then be performed in her court for her under the name of William Shakespeare, underhanded. They didn't, you know, record it because it was like an under the table gig. So then this also correlates to an account by Reverend Dr. John Ward in the 1660s that says Shakespeare was paid £1,000 by the Queen to write two plays each year. So some people think that this £1,000 is the same money. Like it was being paid to Shakespeare. It was being paid to the true author of Shakespeare's plays. I don't know if there's any accounts of Shakespeare receiving money from the Queen. I don't know if he had like a little bank deposit slip. That survived. I don't know. But this is also a really popular theory amongst like some famous thinkers for some reason, including Michael York, Orson Welles, and Sigmund Freud, who once wrote, quote, "The man from Stratford seems to have nothing to justify his claims, whereas Oxford has almost everything." Just like, okay, Freud, go fuck your mom. So again, it's like, why would De Vere want to reject authorship? And the answer is by the theorists that if he wrote plays, it would continue to tarnish his already sullied reputation. But people are really into Oxfordian thought, okay? It has one of the largest academic followings of any of these theories, some of whom hold a conference. It's called the Edward De Vere Studies Conference. And they've been having this conference for like 20 years, and they gather and they talk about this thing. And there was once a court debate in the Supreme Court where these two justices, so there was apparently like a fake debate. I mean, it was a real debate. It was a debate in the United States Supreme Court. And these two justices, Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens, they modified their original rulings against De Vere and stated that they chose him over Shakespeare as the most likely candidate for authorship. So the people are coming around to this one, I guess. I don't know. And let's talk about this more, but I just don't think, why would he lie? So one of the most famous Shakespeare authorship theories, this might be one that you know if you don't know Sir Francis Bacon, is that Shakespeare's friend and rival playwright Christopher Marlowe, who's most famous for writing Dr. Faustus, which Kit Harington was in a revival of in London in, like, 2016. Oh, God. I used to really like Game of Thrones. Basically, people think Marlowe in his early stages and Shakespeare in his early stages were writing the same caliber of work. Because Shakespeare's early plays, like, we get a farce here, we get a love story here. Like, it's sort of, it's not as, I don't know. There's less breadth. There's less breadth to his plays than something like King Lear, right? The plays that are there to for you to have a good time. And him and Shakespeare are both like writing these. I mean, Dr. Faustus is kind of, I mean, it's about Faust. Whatever. So we're like, oh, Christopher Marlowe, William Shakespeare, they're around the same age. They're both writing plays in London at the same time. And they're sort of competitive and rivals, and they're writing in the same style. And they're writing this, they're both writing good plays. And then Marlowe dies really early. He dies in a bar fight, presumably, when he is pretty young. And Shakespeare goes on and has this amazing career and writes all these incredible plays. So we remember Shakespeare. But a lot of people say, they're like, well, if Christopher Marlowe had kept writing, if he hadn't died so young, he would have written stuff just as good as Shakespeare. They showed the exact same amount of potential. So, just like Shakespeare, Marlowe is a commoner. He's the son of a shoemaker. But he did receive education, which so did Shakespeare. Shakespeare went to school when he was a young boy. He didn't go to college, though. He wasn't rich. Marlowe eventually goes to University of Cambridge on scholarship. So he's poor kid on scholarship, unlike Shakespeare, who didn't go to college. After Marlowe goes to university, he goes to London, and then he starts being a playwright. And he's pretty successful. It's kind of like if you think of like anyone who like got their MFA and then like became a playwright and they were like pretty successful. Whereas like William Shakespeare does like the Lucas Neith and he's like, oh, I have four great plays. Does anyone want to do them? And people are like, yeah. Yeah, even though we don't know who you are. Oh, this one's so wild. Okay, so the Marlowe theory is that Marlowe didn't die. Oh, I should have read this whole paper before I started reading about it. Marlowe's killed in a bar fight. Or is he? Because some people think that Marlowe faked his own death, escaped to Italy, because so many of Shakespeare's plays are set in Italy, and then he FedExes his plays to Shakespeare, who managed them and then took credit for them. Other people believe that Marlowe and Shakespeare collaborated, and then, oh, this is interesting. Some people think they collaborated, and there actually, I think, is at least one play that we really think they both worked on. What is that one called? But people think that maybe they collaborated. People think that maybe they collaborated, and Marlowe would write the dialogue of the nobleman because he was rich, and Shakespeare would write the dialogue of like the grave digger in Hamlet, I guess. I don't fucking know. So basically, they thought that William Shakespeare wrote like all the fart jokes and like all the like prose that was ugly, and that Marlowe wrote all the beautiful things because he was high class and he went to fancy school. Or alternatively, Marlowe maybe acted as a mentor to Shakespeare, edit his early works, and then Shakespeare found his footing as an artist because of Marlowe's mentorship. Which, like, whatever, what the fuck ever? Like, if you have a mentor, that doesn't mean that you're a worse playwright or that your work isn't. That'd be like being like, oh, well, Paula Vogel was Sarah Rule's mentor, so Paula Vogel basically wrote those plays. Like, no, she didn't. She helped her, she was a teacher. Whatever. So the faking death theory has roots in Marlowe was charged with heresy because he had this pamphlet on him at one point that was like atheist leaning. He had some propaganda on him, and the government found this, and they were like, oh, it's Marlowe's. And if he was atheist in Catholic England, is it Catholic or is it Protestant? Oh God. If he was atheist in England, he would be executed. So people think that he escaped England, faked his own death, so that they wouldn't execute him, and then he wrote under the name of Shakespeare. This is actually some truth or bullshit, but there's some weird stuff with Christopher Marlowe's death. There were some weird circumstances with like the reporting of Marlowe's death. Like people say it happened really differently, which could of course be like people like memory working, you know, people remember things differently, especially in high trauma situations. But there's a couple weird incidents. I think someone says like, oh, he was stabbed, and one guy's like, oh, he was shot or whatever. So for the Marlowians, the most important piece of evidence to support their theory is Henry VI. So opinions on chronology differ, but it is generally agreed that Henry VI was one of Shakespeare's earliest works and was probably written in about 1591. By this time, Marlowe had already been living in London and making a successful living as a playwright. So people think that Marlowe wrote or at least assisted Shakespeare in the writing of Henry VI. Because there were no drafts found of Henry VI. There were no drafts, there were no revisions, there were no earlier versions. We have the version we have, and if that's the first version, it's like really good for someone who'd never written a play before. So they're like, oh, this play is really good. There's no way a first timer could have done this, right? It had to have been Christopher Marlowe, who had already written some plays. So they do this thing, and it's called word adjacency. And it's an application. It's basically like an algorithm, but like a analog algorithm. Like these people pour through and start analyzing this text. They're basically trying to find differences in style to identify what parts might have written by one person and what parts might have been written by another. They're trying to be like, oh, like there's some stylistic sort of disjunction here. Like maybe there was I'm just explaining this so bad. So they're trying to tell if maybe some parts seemed like they were written by a different person, like if the style and the voice was not consistent. And they're trying to identify two voices, one of William Shakespeare and one of Christopher Marlowe. So word adjacency, what you do is figure out how different authors, where they place, how far they tend to place a set of pre-selected words called target words. So it's like basically a habit of how you speak or how you write. They'll be able to identify by how close particular words are to each other. And apparently you tend to have one pattern of placement. So basically they find out. So basically they're studying Henry VI and they find out that there are two voices. And they do this test on all of Shakespeare's plays, and the rest of Shakespeare's plays all have one voice. They have like this one person's style and placement of words. So they do this testing on all his plays, and then they do his testing on Henry VI. And they found that the placement word pattern, the word adjacency, matched Marlowe's style for Act 1, Act 4, Scene 2, and the middle and late scenes featuring Joan of Arc, quote, of Part 1, Act 1 of Part 2, and Act 1 of Part 3. So basically they think Shakespeare wrote most of it, and then they have a couple scenes that Marlowe must have helped with. So Shakespeare was like, oh, hey, Chris, can you write all the Joan of Arc scenes? And Chris was like, yeah. And, oh, can you, like, write the beginning scene? Whatever. Like, basically, that they collaborated on this play. But basically, people think that this word adjacency shit is bullshit. They think that it's, like, based on mathematical probability. They think it's fake. And it doesn't take into account that, like, stylistically, one might change over the course of their career. Like, maybe you start... I don't know, think about Picasso, who started, you know, painting these realistic portraits, and then he moves into Cubism, and you look at a portrait from his early years next to the Cubism, and you're like, oh, that doesn't look like the same artist, but it is. So if you, you know, are an anthropologist, and you're looking at the two Picasso paintings, you might be like, oh, well, these are two different styles, they're two different artists, but actually, artists are capable of forming a voice and a style. It's actually the thing that artists do as they age, I think. So it doesn't take that into account. Regardless, the influence of Marlowe on Shakespeare continues to be investigated. And people talk about it all the time. So these are three of a lot of theories. There are so many more of who wrote Shakespeare. It is bizarre. It gets to be bizarre. They'll be like, oh, well, this maid of Lady Dornbury of Canterbury, like, once saw Shakespeare through a window, so maybe she wrote it. Like, they're wild. But, like, the thing is, we're never gonna know. Like, we think these works are attributed to William Shakespeare, and we found out a little bit about William Shakespeare, and we have an image. It doesn't matter if he's real. Like, the fact of the matter is that we don't know what this guy talked like. We don't know how he treated the people he loved. We don't know anything about him. So, but we have these plays that we adore, and we study, and we perform over and over again. And, like, I mean, he's become folklore, right? Like, nobody's ever going to care how tall he was, because the thing that he did for us was, like, speak to the truth of being a person, and that's what matters about it. So, basically, we don't know for sure that William Shakespeare wrote his plays, and we don't know for sure that anyone else did either. So my advice to you is to just say that William Shakespeare wrote his plays, because otherwise you're really annoying to everyone. But also, just go forth and enjoy them and don't give a shit. And remember that lots of times they are actually pretty problematic. Basically, we're doing a lot of assuming, and you know what happens when you do that. Okay, ready? I'm gonna high five and pretend JC. Ready?